At this time, I want to present your host for today's session, Peggy Cremo from the U.S. Access Board.
Thanks, Claudia, and welcome everyone to our open Q&A session. We do this session twice a year, typically in March and September, and it's an opportunity for you to ask questions on any topic that the board has involvement with or has authority over, whether it be the standards, the 2010 standard or the Architectural Barriers Act standard. Now, I mentioned March, so I have to begin with an apology that we had to reschedule this session that was originally scheduled for March, but we had to reschedule for this month. And we apologize for that. And for those of you who may have originally been registered for the Frontier Issues session, we will reschedule that session. We have not rescheduled it as of yet, but we anticipate it to occur in the fall. So we'll post that schedule from October to March in the very near future. So you might want to take a look at Accessibility Online website for the updated schedule. So today we have two presenters, Marcia Maz, who's the Director of the Office of Information and Technical Services, and Rex Pace, who's Technical Assistance Coordinator for the Office of Information and Technical Services. So you're going to hear from two people who have lots and lots of experience working with the standards. They're going to begin across the session by responding to the questions that were submitted in advance. Now remember, these were the ones that were submitted in March for that session. So we just continued with the same advanced questions, but we should have plenty of time at the end to respond to questions live here during the session. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Rex.
Well, thank you, Peggy. It's great to be here today and be answering questions with Marcia. So let's go over our session agenda. We're going to start off with accessible routes. We're going to talk about a variety of issues, technical clarifications, scope issues, and even some cost concerns. We'll move on to plumbing. We'll talk about, these are mainly technical clarifications, and then we'll go on to communications, where we'll talk about signage and listening systems and some interrelated or related regulatory issues. We'll go to housing, talk about a couple of scope issues, then go to other category, which is kind of a collection of questions that didn't quite fit into the other categories. Then we'll talk about our future rulemakings and some questions about that and some updates on the various status. And then at the end, we have a kind of an everything in the kitchen sink question. We thought we'd make a good finale for today's presentation. So let's go on to slide 14. So now we'll start off with accessible routes, and let's go to slide 15, and we'll talk about our first question. So we had a question where somebody asked, are there any requirements for bus stops to be located close to the entrance of a public accommodation, or is it permissible to locate a stop at the edge of a site instead? And the questioner gave the example of a shopping mall complex where we have a bus shelter that's located in an outer parking lot by the roadway and not by the main entrance to the actual shops. And the answer to this is no, there is no requirement that addresses this issue. Of course, a bus stop, as a public transportation stop, is required to connect by an accessible route to the building entrances it serves, as per section 206.2.1 site arrival points. And you should note that the bus shelter must connect to the boarding and lighting area, that's where you get on and off the bus at, and this area must connect sidewalks and other pedestrian paths by an accessible route. But there is no requirement like for parking, which must be located on the shore's accessible route. You don't have that for bus shelters. And on this slide, we have a couple of examples. The image at the top is showing a bus stop out in the open by road. And then the one beneath it is showing a bus shelter that's located in a more compact urban environment right at the entrance it serves. The location of a bus stop requires multiple considerations. There is no overriding accessibility requirement that necessarily puts it on the shortest route. Let's go to slide 16. So while we're here on the subject, just to reiterate something about the clear floor space that must be located in a bus stop, in a bus shelter. Of course, the space should be located covered in the proposed public rights of way accessibility guidelines. There's been a clarification in this requirement for transit shelters, which includes bus shelter, requiring that at least a foot and a half of space out in front of the bench is provided for individuals to sit down and have clearance for their knees and toes. You can't cram the clear floor space right up on the bench. You have to give some distance in there. You can't cheat, so to speak. All right, let's go to slide 17. So the next question we had was, we were asked to please clarify the intent of doorway position adjacent to ramp landings. And the questioners said there are different interpretations. From some saying doorways are not allowed along the 60-inch length of landing. This is the landing that's at the top of the ramp, the bottom too, which runs at least 60 inches out in front of the slope. Does the term adjacent mean the actual swing of the door must occur beyond the 60-inch clear dimension? And the questioner expressed concerns that if the door swings, if the door is swinging over this landing, that a person with mobility might be forced back onto the slope of the ramp to open the door. This would be awkward and maybe even dangerous. So section 405.7.5 doorways permits the maneuvering clearances required by 404.2.4 and 404.3.2 for doors and gates, these are the maneuvering clearances, to overlap the required landing area of a ramp. So these maneuvering clearances do include the swing of the door, so therefore the door can go over the ramp landing. So as the questioner pointed out, the main concern is would this require a person in a wheelchair to have to back up onto the slope part of the ramp after landing? And it should not be the case because the maneuvering clearance for the door is including somebody maneuvering around that door to open it. Now, there are situations where this might be tight. It might require some repositioning away from the landing, but it is doable. Now, we would certainly acknowledge that having the door swing itself outside the landing best practice. This is not the entire maneuvering clearance, but the door swing itself having that not swing over the landing would be consistent with general design practices for building use and circulation. But this is really more about people getting caught by surprise with having the door open up on them as they're coming to the top of the ramp. That would characterize as less of a maneuvering issue that's strictly related to the wheelchairs. So on this image here we have on the slide, we have an example where we have a landing at the top of the ramp. It does overlap with the maneuvering clearance for the door. But the door swing itself is not over the ramp landing. So this is kind of an image of what we consider a good practice approach. Go to the next slide, slide 18. And here we have a very generous landing, a very large landing. And I like to show this because you can see that there's overlap between the ramp landing and the maneuvering clearance for the door, even on the big landing. So that's not that unusual. They do have a tendency to overlap in entrance situations where you have a landing right over the door. So I just want to point that out. So overlap doesn't happen. The key issue, again, is the door swing. Go to slide 19. So we had another question. We were asked when, if ever, are power-operated doors required in new construction or alterations? And would there be a difference between state and local governments, Title II, versus public accommodation, which is Title III? And no, automatic and power-assisted doors are never mandated. These provisions are only an issue if you decide to use these door types. And there are no differences between Title II and Title III buildings and facilities. Now, there may be situations where the use of these doors offers benefits to the facility, like an automatic sliding door at a grocery store. You can see where that makes a lot of sense, have all aboard, people carrying packages and so forth out. Or sometimes, like we have in the slide here, the image in the slide here, where we have a a power operated door, automatic door, which you press a button, it opens up, where you may have a limited floor area that have maneuvering clearances. In which case we have, we have a difficulty in this particular example is a historic facility. It might be difficult to provide that space to the last side of the door. So this is, a good solution in an alteration situation. But I think we had a little bit of noise interference there. So let's talk a little bit about these door types, just to kind of do a rundown of the power assist door. This is the kind of door that you come up to and you pull the door lead, and then the power kicks in and the door continues to open. That requires you to maneuver in place. So those always have to have the maneuvering clearances of section 404.2.4. Because you actually have to maneuver in place to activate these. Automatic doors, again, the ones that you control, that you would activate by control or automatically activate when a user opens the door. In either case, you would have to actually operate the door lead. So these may or may not require maneuvering clearances depending on several conditions. Automatic doors that are not on a means of egress are not required to provide maneuvering clearances. However, this is pretty rare. It's much more likely that these will be on a means of egress. If an automatic door is on an accessible means of egress, it's required to provide the maneuvering clearances if there's not standby power provided. Because in an emergency situation, the power might go out, and then you'd have to open the doors manually. So you have to have the maneuvering clearances. But if you do have standby power, then you don't have to do the clearances. And an exception to the section addresses another possibility, and that is if you had a door and the power went out, and the door returned to the open position, which is liable to case, it's like sliding doors, like the grocery store we talked about, then if it comes to the open position, you would also not have to provide moving clearance. So the takeaway from this is they're not the power automatic and power assisted doors are not required by the ADA or the ABA standard. Standards, and if you use them, be careful about what's going on with maneuvering clearance. However, let's go to slide 20. While standards don't require these kind of things, for those of you who do work with the federal government, or work on federal projects, you will want to bear in mind the GSAs, that's the General Service Administration's Public Buildings Service Facility Standards, the P100. It does have a requirement at section 1.3.7. That at least one building entrance comply with section 404.3, that one of them be an automatic or power assisted door. So that has a national reach and the issue is out there, but again, that's not really a mandate from the civil rights law. That's more of a contractual issue for a construction project standard. So let's do this slide 21. Question, where there is a long path of travel on a public transportation facility, like an airport, rail station, or a ferry terminal, is a moving sidewalk required? And would it be a different answer for a cruise ship terminal? And no, moving sidewalks are never required by the standards. So they're not required. However, I would note that that sometimes you will see signs posted on these moving walkways saying that people using mobility devices should use them. Such prohibitions on the use features by people with disabilities must be based on legitimate data about safety risk and not speculation. Therefore, unless this has been actually demonstrated to be the case, these walks should be allowed to be used by people with disabilities. So I would be skeptical about such claims of signage posted on these. So let's go to slide 22. So we had a question, a person was talking about a Title II facility, housing at a place of education, which we'll talk a little more about. In this particular application, they were warning that the exception for section 206.2.3, section 5, which it was for an actual individual unit or for a multi-story building with units on multiple floors. So, and this is the first off, section 5 of section 206.2.3, this is the multi-stories and buildings and facilities requirement. It applies to multiple stories within a particular transient lodging guest room with mobility features. And it's not talking about like the hotel four levels. is talking about within the unit. So, and this accepts an accessible route between multiple stories inside the unit if the required accessible spaces are open exponent accessible route and accommodations for at least two people are on a story served by the accessible route. Basically meaning if you have one floor that works for two people in all the accessible way, then you don't have to provide an accessible route to the other stories. However, our question is slide 23. So, slide 23. Thank you. However, our questioner asked about a unit in a housing at a place of education, which in fact cannot utilize this exception 5. When DOJ updated ADA regulations, housing at a place of public education, you know, such as a university dormitory, were acknowledged as being covered by transient lodging. However, given the unique nature of these, because these are really kind of a combination of transient lodging, but they also are a place where people live for an extended time, so they do have a kind of a residential dwelling unit kind of aspect to them. And therefore, they added a couple of important requirements, so actually three important requirements, and of course, these changes were incorporated into the standard. So let's go to slide 24. So, and then one of these requirements, so the one that requires an accessible route throughout the housing unit, this is coming from section 809.2.1, pretty much negates the other exception that the questioner was asking about, because this route must go through all the spaces in the unit. Okay, so let's go to slide 25. And now I'm going to turn it over to Marcia, who will take us into the rest of our accessible route questions.
Thank you, Rex. All right, so we have a bunch of questions here that relate to path of travel, accessible routes scoping, how many accessible routes are required, and entrances scoping. The questioner ultimately asked about alterations to non-historic buildings, noting that there is a specific requirement for alterations to entrances to historic buildings. Let's move on to slide 26. So in this particular question, the questioner noted that exception 2 for historic buildings is more specific than exception 1, and wondered about the overlap between exception 1 and exception 2 to 206.4 entrances. And the fact of the matter is exception 2 really in its first sentence, which says no more than one public entrance shall be required to comply with 206.4, doesn't really differ from the content of exception 1, where it says where an alteration includes alterations to an entrance, and the entrance building or facility, or any building or facility has another entrance that is accessible, that you don't have to make the altered entrance accessible. So in the end, both exceptions 1 and exception 2 allow you to have only one accessible route in accessible entrance to a building, provided that you meet the path of travel requirements. If you are going to meet the path of travel requirements with that one accessible entrance and you are altering an area containing a primary function, then of course you are going to have to go and do more work. Slide 27, please. So, generally speaking, the only requirement for accessible routes is a requirement that all elements and spaces are connected with an accessible route. So, generally speaking, you never are required to provide more than one accessible route to an element. The difference here is that for new construction, you are required to provide a number of accessible entrances. And so I think perhaps the questioner was confusing entrances and accessible routes, but in any case, one accessible route in an alteration is sufficient. Whether it's an accessible route through an entrance or an accessible route to a toilet room or a telephone or drinking fountain serving an altered primary function area, one accessible route, whether it's a historic building or a non-historic building. If it's a historic building and we're talking about entrances and you cannot make a public entrance accessible, exception two on the previous slide does allow you to make a non-public entrance accessible under certain conditions. Slide 28. This is a reiteration of the requirements for alterations when it comes to elements. Again, the exception here in 202.3, alterations, unless required by 202.4, which is path of travel, where elements and spaces are altered and the circulation path to the altered element or space is not altered, an accessible route shall not be required. So you may not have to provide an accessible route if you alter just one element unless you have a requirement for path of travel because you're altering an area containing a primary function. So, again, it does get confusing with respect to the difference between elements, entrances, and path of travel. But generally speaking, again, one accessible route to each and every accessible element in new construction, 60% accessible entrances. And each of those entrances has to be connected by at least one accessible route to all elements and spaces. The next slide, slide 29, relates to another question we got about path of travel. The questioner asks whether they can exempt certain costs from the base cost for path of travel. And so basically, they say, what can be subtracted from calculating the cost of an alteration to a primary function area? Can I subtract costs such as incidental repairs, re-roofing, and other work that is not considered an alteration according to the definition? So in this slide, and I don't know how we bounced around here, but we should be on slide 29. Okay. On slide 29, okay, that's the definition of path of travel, slide 30. Okay. The questioner again asks whether they can subtract from the cost of an alteration to a primary function area such costs that are not considered alterations. And the Department of Justice is the authority on this, not the Access Board, but we would suggest that the plain language of the requirement is it's the cost of alterations, 20% of the cost of alterations. So if the work you're doing is not an alteration by the definition, then you would not include those costs in your base number for deciding what 20% is. So you would subtract out any costs related to things like re-roofing, painting, wallpapering, mechanical and electrical systems. The next slide shows you how you would calculate that. So you have cost pertaining to primary function areas is only $100,000 as opposed to $200,000 in terms of the budget for everything you did. Those things that are not alterations are taken out, and you base your 20% on the cost pertaining to the primary function areas and only the primary function areas. A note of caution here, the questioner also asks about the cost of typical maintenance items. And they give some examples, such as plumbing, cost to do plumbing. Well, if that plumbing does not affect or cannot affect the usability of the altered area, then it's not an alteration. But if it has the potential to affect the usability of the altered area, then by the DOJ definition, that change to the plumbing, let's just say we're moving toilet fixtures around, is in fact an alteration. So it is a bit tricky. If you are in doubt, I would suggest that you contact the Department of Justice and talk to them about your specific condition, because I'm not aware that DOJ has provided any formal guidance on how to calculate that 20%. So I would suggest that you contact DOJ if you are in a gray area there. Okay. The next slide, slide 32, we have questions about accessible means of egress. And as everybody knows, the guidelines reference the International Building Code for Accessible Means of Egress. And next slide, please, slide 33. The questioner asks about the common path of egress travel required by the International Building Code. And a common path of egress travel allows you to use one route where two exits are required, where two accessible means of egress are required, in order to get to a point where you have a choice of two exits. So you may, for example, in an assembly area have a requirement for two exits, but you can use one route for a short distance defined in the International Building Code in order to get you to that point where you have the choice of two exits. So the questioner was asking whether this requirement is further borne out in the International Building Code in the current edition, section 1028.8, Common Path of Egress Travel, which actually limits the length of that route to 30 feet in some conditions, and also can limit it to 50 feet or 75 feet, depending on other conditions. And yes, what the exception does is it points you back to the enforceable building code in your jurisdiction. So if the International Building Code is your building code, then yes, you would be limited to that accessible common path of egress travel to the length specified in your building code. And the questioner also asked about assembly areas with sloped or stepped aisles and asked if one means of egress is permitted where the common path of travel is accessible. No, you still have two means of egress. You simply have a common path of travel to that point of decision where you then have two choices. So basically it would be shaped something like a Y, where you travel up the stem for a very short distance, and then you have an option of going in one direction or another, and those two directions are remote from one another. So it doesn't allow you to have one means of egress, but it does allow you to have one short route to take you to that point where you have choices. Rex, you're up.
Talk button. All right. Well, that's always informative, Marcia. Informative as always. So let's go on to plumbing, and let's go on to slide 35. And we had a question. Somebody had a question about how the length of the grab bar is established. And the questioner figured that since the space between walls and grab bars must be at least an inch and a half, it should be an inch and a half inches, as per section 609.3, this would be a major factor in determining length. So it's shown here. We talk about that inch and a half between the wall and the back of the grab bar, which is in the absolute dimension. And they ask if this means that the measurement of the bar length only includes those parts of the bar where this clearance is provided and not where it's less, such as the mounting brackets, including where the bar has a curve and turn to the wall. Let's go to the next slide, 36. And on the image on the left, you in this photograph, you can see where the bar is coming along and it curves and returns into the wall. And if that would discount that area, since it's less than an inch and a half from the wall, is that would be discounted from determining the length. And no, this would not necessarily be the case. Remember, the 1.5 inch requirement is for the space between the wall and the grab bar. It's not a requirement for length. Grab bar length is set for water closets, bathtubs, and shower types in each section that addresses the fixture type. Now, it's convention in the plumbing industry to set grab bar length to the center of the end session plates. And it's also acceptable as the minimum length of a grab bar for an accessible toilet or in an accessible bathing fixture. And it's reflected in the figure here on the right from the standard. We can see that the length is set, is indicating a length is set to the middle of the special plate or mounting brackets. We do accept that as determination of length. So let's go to slide 37. We had another questioner who asked if you had a grab bar that was 48 inches long, but it was mounted less than 12 inches from the wall, it would not be in compliance because it wouldn't meet the 54-inch minimum from the wall to the far end of the bar. So they asked what was better, to ensure the overall distance is 54 inches from the rear wall or that the closest end of the bar is no more than 12 inches from the rear wall. And the answer is they both equally matter. Each dimension serves a different purpose and must be met. Now, people want to use the grab bar, each end of the grab bar a different way. For the bar that's alongside the toilet, closest to the wall behind the toilet, that ends in important to people who do side transfers onto the toilet. A lot of people will need extra options along that area, and for people repositioning on the toilet. Now, the end of the bar that's furthest from the toilet is out at 54 inch minimum distance end. That'll be important for people who are doing perpendicular transfers and will want additional space out in front of the toilet. They're both equally important, and if you are concerned about having a fudge factor here, because it all works out to be a very specific set of dimensions, you might want to use a bar that's a little bigger than 42-inch minimum to kind of give yourself some leeway on this issue if that's a concern. But you have to meet all dimensions. One is not more important than the other. They're all equally important. Let's go to slide 38. So another question we have was somebody was asking if the seat height requirement in section 604.4 and the toilet paper dispenser locations in section 604.7, if these apply to ambulatory accessible compartments. And yes, they do. And this is reflected in the structure of the provision and the standards. All of the requirements apply. And where these need to deviate for features necessary for one type of stall as opposed to the other, a prime example being like the width, an ambulatory stall is 35-37, and a wheelchair accessible toilet stall has to be at least 15 inches wide. So there you that's called out specifically when there's a difference, and that's reflected in the way the requirements are structured. So let's go to slide 39. So we have a question. One questioner noted that the standards require a shower spray unit that shall have an on-off control with a non-positive shutoff. But the 2009 version of the ICC ANSI A117.1, this version does not reference the on-off feature. And basically, are the two standards saying something different from one another? And note that the ICC ANSI generates the national accessibility codes, national accessibility standards that are adopted into international building code. So often these requirements will be showing up in the same way in practice, so these requirements will overlap. So they wanted to know if there was a difference. But there is no content difference just because the text doesn't include the text on off is not used in both. They're really talking about the same thing, the wording difference. To have a shut off means that you can control it. And note that the non-positive feature is the duple valve concept we've talked about before. Again, there's really no difference between these two. Just perhaps a little better editing in one as opposed to the other. So let's go to slide 40. And I'll turn it back over to Marcia, who will talk about communications issues.
Thank you, Rex. Okay, so we're on to slide 41 in communications. And the questioner has asked where are assistive listening systems required, and just as a reminder to everybody, the requirement applies to assembly areas. We have a definition for assembly areas where audible communication is integral to the use of the space. And next slide, please. The questioner says, well, heck, when is audible communication not integral to the use of an assembly space? Next slide. From our perspective, we've sort of fleshed that out with our definition of assembly areas. We say that assembly areas include classrooms, lecture halls, courtrooms, public meeting rooms, public hearing rooms, legislative chambers, motion picture houses, auditoria, theaters, playhouses, dinner theaters, concert halls, centers for performing arts, amphitheaters, arenas, stadiums, grandstands, and convention centers. So all of these places are places where people assemble, usually to exchange cultural information with one another, to discuss matters, and so audible communication is integral to the use of each and every one of these spaces. However, there are probably some communications that might go on, for example, in a sporting facility that may not be considered integral to the use of the space. For example, you may have a situation where you have a hawker selling drinks and running up and down the bleachers in a sporting facility. In that situation, the audible communication is not necessarily integral to the use of the space because you usually are going to be communicating with that individual verbally and visibly, you know, motioning over here, I need a drink over here, or I want popcorn. But that is not necessarily an integral feature of the use of the space itself. Next slide, please. Slide 44. The questioner asks, is assistive listening sufficient to ensure effective communication? And they further ask, can they swap out in a sporting facility a scrolling board, a scrolling message board or other Jumbotron or something like that for the assistive listening, required assistive listening, and just provide that? Well, the answer to that question is no. The assistive listening is required. The assistive listening does allow people who are hard of hearing to access the audible information directly. A scrolling message board or Jumbotron or other similar variable message sign may very well be necessary in order to communicate effectively with people who cannot hear at all. And so that brings us to the Department of Justice requirements for effective communication in slide 45. So the questioner asked, where can I find these other requirements? And so I've given you citations here for both the Title II requirements in 28 CFR 35, subpart E communications, and for the Title III ADA requirements and 28 CFR 36.303, Auxiliary Agent Services. And this is where you would find requirements for effective communication for individuals with disabilities. So the Department of Justice regulations require, in addition to compliance with the ADA standards, that you ensure that your communication with individuals with disabilities is as effective as it is with everyone else. And on slide 46, we show you an example of auxiliary aids and services. This is a shot of a public hearing. I think it was a DOJ public hearing. And you'll see on the slide that we have the CART service on the screen, providing a real-time transcription of what is being said. Plus, also, there is a sign language interpreter, because not everybody who is deaf is proficient in reading real-time text. And American Sign Language or some other form of sign language may be, in fact, their native language. So there are some examples of auxiliary aids and services. There are others, such as requirements to provide a handheld magnifier for individuals at a retail store where that individual may need to look more closely at things than the casework allows. Slide 47. The questioner also asked for some tips on how they might accommodate someone with low vision during a visual presentation. These are my suggestions. They're not written, carved in stone anywhere. They're not requirements per se, but these are my personal suggestions for things that you might do to accommodate someone with low vision when you are doing a presentation. First, if the person makes their needs known beforehand, reserve seats close to the presentation if they let you know that would facilitate their participation. Also, provide alternate formats, preferably the format that the person would find most convenient to use and to allow them to participate most fully. Some people prefer large print, others prefer electronic files. When I do a presentation, what I like to do, if we are giving out handouts, usually for most people, you do the three slides on the page with the notes lines, which are hard for someone who has low vision to see. So I usually have at least one set available that is a printout of all of the slides, or each slide, one slide per page, and that way someone with low vision can follow along with the presentation and actually see what's up on screen. So the other thing is electronic files. Some people like to have the electronic file. They'll just load it onto their iPad or to their computer. And again, follow along with the speaker as best they can and see what is being presented. And typically you would need to provide that accommodation in advance of the date so that the person has time to load it up onto their computer or onto their device. And lastly, describe visual presentations. Even for people with low vision who have the accommodations available, it's easy to miss something, particularly if you're pointing to it and saying, well, look over here in the upper left-hand corner, and not saying what individual is supposed to look at. So make sure that your presentation includes some rich description of what we're looking at up there in the upper left-hand corner. And lastly, always ask the person what it is that they need, what their preferences are. Sometimes you'll save yourself some time and energy. Some people want the kitchen sink, but I think most people are very, very reasonable. And if you ask them, you will save yourself the trouble of providing an accommodation that isn't wanted. Rex, you're up.
Are you going to do the signs
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. No, you're right. I cannot. Oh,
yes,
yeah. Okay.
You have to do the sign from Hawaii.
All right. I have to do signs. Okay. So slide 48. This is a question that we received from someone asking about signs that have a foreign language translation on them. And I'm not even going to try to pronounce the word here. But the image shows a international men's room sign with the guy wearing a Hawaiian shirt, which is quite cute. And underneath it says in raised letters, men, and then in possibly in raised letters, I'm not sure, the Hawaiian word for men, and then below that, the Braille English for men. And so the questioner wants to know, are we required to do this? The ADA standards require raised letters for the sign designation, and they require Braille. Next slide, 49. Braille, as specified in the ADA standards, is grade 2 Braille, English literary Braille. So the standards do not require you to Braille foreign language. Now, the Department of Justice, again, is the entity that would determine what constitutes a disability and what disabilities need to be accommodated. I think it's fair to say that speaking a foreign language is itself not a disability, but whether or not you would need some other kind of accommodation, or if the facility typically provides all their signs in a foreign language, then I would check with the Department of Justice and ask DOJ whether they have an expectation that you would provide the foreign language translation in Braille. But it will not be grade 2 Braille as specified in the standards, because that grade 2 refers specifically to English Braille, literary Braille. Slide 50. Somebody asked whether when providing a room designation and also a room function, whether both the designation, the number usually, and the designation have to be raised letters and Braille. In this particular example, it says John Smith, director. That's the occupant name. The occupant name is considered temporary information and is exempt. And it says then provides the function of the room, accounting. And then lastly provides the number of the room, room 123. In this instance, the designer has elected to raise letter and Braille only the room number 123. Next slide, please. Okay. What we say is that you are only required to provide one, let's just say you have two bits of information. One is the room designation itself or the room number, and another is a secondary designation or function of the room, such as the library or in the example shown here, men's room and or restroom. We don't think it makes a lot of sense, although most restrooms do have a room number, to Braille the room number. That doesn't make any sense because we don't direct people down to the restroom, room 3422. We say the restroom is down the hall to the left, or the men's room is down the hall to the left, not 3422 is down the hall to the left. So what we suggest is that the designers really think carefully about how that room is going to be referred to in your signage program. Are people going to refer to that room normally by its number or by its function? And then you would be required to select one of those two, the designations, room number or room function, to be accessible, but not both. You are not required to select both, and there's no penalty for choosing the wrong one. We do suggest, best practice, really think about how that room is going to be referred to in the future. And now it's your turn. Slide 52.
All right, thanks so much, Marcia. And let's talk some about housing. Let's go on to slide 53. So the first question in this category, the questioner asked, what good resources and information are there on regulations for homeless shelters and transitional housing? Are there any particular areas where homeless shelters tend to fail in their facility obligations? Well, there are requirements in the standards because of several issues that have consistently arisen in this context. Again, when the ADA standards were updated, several requirements were added specifically addressing what are called social service center establishments. And that would include something like homeless shelters. And these are now incorporated in the standards. Look at the slide 54. And the two big issues that have come up and were addressed in the standards were access to beds, sleeping beds, and accessible bathing options that were flexible for a wide range of users. So we now have a requirement that in sleeping rooms of more than 25 beds, a minimum of 5% of the beds must have clear floor space meeting 806.2.3. And I'll show you that in a minute. Also, facilities with more than 50 beds and provide common use bathing facilities must provide at least one roll-in shower with a seat. And if you provide bathing facilities for each gender, then in each of those facilities, men and women each would have to have a roll-in shower with a seat. So this is slide 55. Now, the space for the beds is a clear floor space, parallel approach. The clear floor space for a parallel approach in section 305 has to be provided to each side of the bed so that you have a choice of right and left transfer. But you could also, if you have two beds together, you could also locate the space between the two beds. And the point here is that somebody can have a choice to transfer to the left and right. Of course, accessible route will be an issue, and this will affect the space between the beds too. Let's do the slide 56. Of course, the other big requirement here is for a roll-in shower with a seat. This could also be the alternate compartment layout too, if it has a seat. And again, this was done to provide the most flexible shower option when it came to the shower situation, so people would be able to transfer on to the seat and so forth. Let's go to slide 57. Okay, so the other question we have has to do with what I would call a resident manager units. The question concerns like resident manager units in university dormitory, or you have like a student who actually has duties overseeing the dorm room and they're provided a special unit. And also it concerns something you might find like a hotel manager unit in a transient lodging, like so where the owner or supervisor of a hotel actually lives in one of like a bona fide guest room. So the question of a unit offering a full-time living arrangement, if it's provided for a resident manager in the dormitory, their responsibility, would that have to comply with Section 233? And also, does it make a difference if an educational setting versus a similar type of unit in the hotel? All right, so it kind of brings up a question about dispersion of units among types. So if you remember, a university dormitory is a kind of lodging situation. So you must provide the minimum number of units. You figure out how many dwelling units you have to provide that are accessible, guest rooms. And you disperse them among the types of units offered in a manner that gives people with disabilities a comparable choice as others. This is also the case in residential requirements. You figure out the minimum number and you disperse among the types of units you offer. So it's just pretty parallel. And a resident unit manager, in terms of the dormitory situation, a resident manager unit is a type. So you would consider that. However, it is possible that you may have more types of units than you actually have accessible units to. For instance, you might have some more types of bedroom units than you have requirement for accessible units. You're not required to increase the number of accessible units. You're not required to do one of each type. You're just required to disperse among the types you have, and you can elect to do that to a resident manager unit or not. depending on, you know, how your numbers play out. However, you should bear in mind that there's some non-discrimination issues here that are going on, because it is a particular opportunity you're offering, and you have to consider would that arise, the issues would arise, particularly in the context of a state and local government facility where you would have program access obligations. So you would consider in your program in its entirety, you know, does a person with a disability have an opportunity to take advantage of the benefits that are offered of being a resident manager in a dormitory setting? And if, and they, so, you know, there could be, where it may not be, you know, a little violation of the standards, you might have other, you know, discrimination issues that could arise in terms of considering your whole program or the goods and services you're offering. Now, let's get back to the hotel where the owner or manager is living in the hotel. And that's a completely different situation. That's actually a place where somebody's living. That's somebody's private residence, someone's home. And it may only be covered by the standards to the extent that it possibly contains an employee work area. And it would not be in that mix. When you're thinking about dispersing among the types, it may not be it's really not a guest room that the public's using, so you're not really putting it in the mix of the what you're dispersing to. So we're going to go to Marsh now for our collection of other issues, and then we'll move on from there.
Okay, thanks, Rex. So we don't have a very big collection of others, actually. We only have two issues here. On slide 59, we're looking at the outdoor bench requirement. And this is my opportunity to say that the guidance that you find online from Victor Stanley is accurate. The ADA standards currently don't require outdoor benches to be accessible and have no criteria for outdoor benches. However, the ABA, Architectural Barriers Act standards, do have requirements for outdoor benches if they are in outdoor developed areas that are subject to the Barriers Act, in other words, federal parks and facilities like that. And one of the questioner also noted that the proposed rule for public rights of way has a proposed requirement for outdoor benches, and that's true. But right now, looking at the requirement for clear floor or ground space next to a bench, they're asking, well, if I'm going to provide it voluntarily, should I provide a 30 by 48 inch space in accordance with the requirements at 305.3 for space to accommodate a stationary wheelchair, or should I use the criteria set forth in the outdoor developed areas rule for Architectural Barriers Act covered facilities, which is 36 by 48 inches as opposed to 30 by 48 inches? And I think the question in that question is and why are these different? I would suggest that you use the 36 by 48 inch dimension if you're going to do this voluntarily, simply to allow for more maneuvering space into that space. Section 305.3 is with a 30 inch dimension really doesn't accommodate a lot of maneuvering. In an outdoor setting, if you've, for example, provided a pavement for that wheelchair space and the pavement then ends and maybe you have sand or dirt or other inaccessible materials, or you have some other kind of barrier that might form an alcove condition, then in fact you would want a wider space, a 36 inch space, just to allow for more maneuvering and also to avoid that alcove condition. So thank you for that question, because it's great that people are considering doing this voluntarily. momentarily while we're still working on the public rights of way criteria and still hoping to bring forward the criteria for outdoor developed areas under the Barriers Act up to into the ADA requirements at some future date. Slide 60. Slide 60 asks about detectable warnings, and apparently there's some confusion in the questioner's mind about what is actually required for detectable warnings. They note that both the ADA and AVA standards only have requirements for detectable warnings at transit platforms and edges like that, and that's correct. However, the Department of Transportation, Federal Highway Administration, for any facilities they fund, as well as in their ADA standards, require detectable warnings at curb ramps and other street crossings. And this questioner said that the Illinois Attorney General's office is not enforcing a requirement for detectable warnings on sites, but the Department of Transportation is, the Illinois Department of Transportation is enforcing a requirement for detectable warnings in the public right-of-way. And that would be correct based on what are the requirements for the ADA, except perhaps transit facilities. If the Illinois Attorney General's office wants to be consistent with the requirements in the DOT ADA standards for a transit facility developed under their jurisdiction, then they would want to have detectable warnings at any crossings on the transit facility site. But other types of sites subject only to the Department of Justice's ADA standards would not be required to have detectable warnings except at transit platforms. The questioner also wanted some confirmation that the ADA requirements are the more stringent. No. The ADA requirements for sites that are not transit facilities are less stringent than any other requirement that, for example, federal highways would apply to facilities they fund. So if the Federal Highway Administration funds the facility, or it is an ADA transit facility subject to DOT's regulations, then the requirements for detectable warnings are more stringent than no requirement at all. I hope that's clear. If it isn't, I invite the questioner to dial me up and we can have a conversation about that. And we're on to the next slide, slide 61, and we are back to Rex to talk about medical diagnostic equipment.
Yes, well, thank you, Marcia. We had a question. What is the status of the board's rulemaking on standards for accessible medical diagnostic equipment, in particular a projected completion date? And also, more specifically, are there details about exam table dimensions that you can share? So in response to the first one on completion date, no, I can't give you a completion date because this rulemaking is process, so can't answer that question. But I can give you some background on the examination table size and the advisory committee. They have some recommendations that relate to that. So in the proposed rulemaking, in the proposed notice of rulemaking, or the what we call the NPRM, an exam table size is not mandated as such, but a transfer surface on the examination surface is what is addressed. So we don't say a table, we did not propose, it was not proposed that the table be, you know, X and XY and X long. What is addressed is a transfer surface. This is a landing area where a person transferring from a mobility device would be able to get onto the critical portion of the examination surface. examination area. And it was proposed in the NPRM as being 30 inches wide and 15 inches minimum deep. And the public comments, there were lots of public comments to this, and this is one of the issues people spoke to, and there were lots of other dimensions proposed from 24 inches to 36 inches, so there was a lot of discussion in the public comments about this. Go to slide 63. So then we convened an advisory committee to give recommendations on what they thought of the proposed standards and of the comments on the standards. And they the committee members of this advisory committee represent a range of stakeholders affected by the rule, from disability advocacy groups to companies that make manufacturing exam tables. And they made several insightful recommendations based on anthropometric data, in particular data from the anthropometry of wheel mobility project. That's a tongue twister. And also, from their discussions, it became apparent that there was a need for a secondary transfer surface. If you will notice on a previous slide, that transfer surface was located at the foot end of the table, so you would come down the foot end and transfer parallel to the surface or perpendicular or some diagonal. But there are certain types of equipment, like they're shown here in this MRI, which is festively decorated as a pirate ship theme. So it's in a pediatric hospital, where you really wouldn't get on this piece of equipment at the foot end. You would probably get on it at the middle or up at the head end. And this, in such situations, became apparent in the advisory committee discussion. So they give you recommendations. And really, for those of you who are concerned with the subject, I really encourage you to go look at the advisory committee report. Here's a link here on the on our slide. You'll find lots of useful discussion and so forth. Let's go to slide 64. And their recommendation was two types of transfer surfaces. One is very similar to what was in the proposed standard, a little bit narrower, a little bit deeper. And then another transfer surface that would accommodate transfers from the side to side of an examination area. That would be more appropriate for like an MRI or a gurney or some kind of imaging type equipment where you wouldn't get on the foot end and slide all the way up to the middle of the equipment. And of course, they acknowledged there would be some equipment where it may be problematic to have these shapes, like imaging equipment where you have bores, and by their very nature, if you're passing a surface through a magnetic ring, it's going to limit the width of the table no matter what. The technology limits the width of it. And they discussed these things and brought these issues. But in general, this is what they recommended. And that's where we are. We have these recommendations, and so you'll have to stay tuned for the rest of the story. And with that, I will turn it over to our office guru on such matters as rulemaking, and Marshall will take us through the rest of them.
Marshall's microphone, is that on?
Okay, sorry. Can you hear me now? Good. All right. Sorry. So self-service transaction machines. The ADA standards require only ATMs and fair vending machines to provide audible output. And other self-service machines currently would have to meet the requirements for operable parts, including a clear floor space so that individuals using wheelchairs would be able to access those. But we are going to come forward with new requirements for self-service transaction machines. And that isn't going to happen right away. Let's move on to slide 66. If you want to get an idea of where we're going with this, please look at the FAA regulations for automated ticketing and kiosks, which were based on our Section 508 requirements as well as the ADA standards Section 707. And I think that will give you a good idea where we plan to go in terms of technical requirements, which we will propose through the rulemaking process for other types of self-service machines. The real trick for us is going to be to establish appropriate scoping for these, and we haven't gotten there yet. Also, I'll note that the Department of Justice has an advanced notice of proposed rulemaking out on equipment and furniture, and for those things that are not built into the environment, you will certainly find that advanced notice of proposed rulemaking of some importance. The next regulation that we're working on is our vehicle guidelines updates for buses and vans and rail. The requirements for buses and vans and what we're calling our rubber tire rule, the next step for that is a final rule, and we should be coming out with that in the near future. That's close up in our pipeline. For rail cars, however, we have a rail access advisory committee that is ongoing right now, and they will be providing us input in the very near future, and you'll be able to take a look at that to see where we may be going in the future with requirements for accessible rail cars. Slide 69, public rights of way. I had several questions about, when are these going to be done? And we hope to have them done in the near future. The next step for public rights of way and shared use paths is, in fact, the final rule. And we are working on the preamble for that now. We've finished the development of the technical requirements, and so it's a matter of getting all the reasons and rationales down in the preamble so that people understand what it is has changed. Slide 70, passenger vessels. RNTRM on passenger vessels was published in June of 2013, and the comment period ended last year. We've also done quite a few drafts of this rule, and it's available to the public. Our next on this one also is a final rule. We're not as far along with our preamble as we are for transportation vehicles and public rights of way. I would expect to see those come first, and then passenger vessels. And oh, here's my slide on rail vehicle guidelines. So again, look for information on our website about the advisory committee. And then moving on to slide 72, information and communications technology. As you know, we published our notice of proposed rulemaking on February 25th, and we held a public hearing on March 5th, and are going to held a second on March 11th at the Access Board's offices. We may, in fact, also have a third public hearing in May during our out-of-town board meeting in Salt Lake City, Utah. So please check our website for that. Our next step for information and communications technology is a final rule. We welcome your comments. We look forward to hearing individual stories that help us to better understand the benefit of that rulemaking. What was the hardest thing to do was to try to quantify who benefits, how people benefit. So individual stories are good things to send us in response to our request for public comment on the ICT rulemaking. Slide 73, the question was really, what should I assemble? What things should I be looking at in order to assemble a decent library of information about accessibility requirements? And so we have a slide here that has everything but the kitchen sink. The International Building Code, the Access Board's accessibility guidelines, because they contain our advisories, which the Department of Justice did not adopt when they adopted the standards, since Federal Register no longer allows advisories to be published in the Federal Register. And also the DOJ ADA standards and regulations. You may, in fact, need previous editions of the ADA standards if you're dealing with an existing facility. So for your Title II entity, you might need the Uniform Federal Accessibility Standards and the earlier Department of Justice regulations and standards, the 1991 standards. Other good resources are the ANSI A117 standards, and there are many editions of those. And also, we put one example, or two examples here, of reference standards, standards that are referenced by the 2010 ADA standards, the International Building Code, as well as the National Fire Alarm Code. The illustration would have gotten a little too messy if we had put all the reference standards in here, but you do would probably want to have the reference standards if you want a complete library of everything. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. Of course, there are many documents that contain guidance material. There are historical documents that discuss the research that underpins these guidelines and standards, all of which you may wish to have if you want a good library on accessibility. And we do have a library here at the Access Board, and we invite you, if you're in town, to come visit us and take a look at our library. And Peggy, with that, I'm handing it back to you.
Okay, thanks, Marcia and Rex. I wanted to make sure we had some time at the end here for questions, and we do have some questions that come in the chat room. Please feel free to submit some additional ones. First question here, are bead changing tables mounted higher than 27 inches above the finished floor considered protruding objects when they're in the open position? Rex, you want to take that?
So this, when they're in the open position?
When they're in the open position.
Okay. I'm assuming at that point they're being used. I'm going to assume that they're being used as a surface and not to be space. I think in that configuration, we would not consider them protruding objects. The main concern is when you fold them up and they're in the position they're intended to be returned to, do they stick out and are protruding objects at that point? And I think that's the main issue there.
Okay. Marcia, I think this might be for you. When the international symbol is used as a standalone symbol, does it have to meet the pictogram size requirements?
Okay. No, it doesn't. If the international symbol is being used as a bit of information about a space, if that symbol is just there to say, hey, this is an accessible space, or this is an accessible entrance, then it does not have to meet the requirements for a pictogram, and there does not need to be accompanying braille or raised letters, because at that point it's an informational sign as opposed to a sign designating a room or space. And as a matter of fact, I can't think of too many situations where the ISA would be the room designation. Even on a pictogram that, like the one I showed earlier, that showed a restroom sign that had the international symbol, the international symbol for men would have been the pictogram that equates to the room designation, the little man pictogram, as opposed to the ISA, which is informational only. It's called the men's room, not the accessible room.
Okay, so I think this is another one for you, Marcia. You talked about assisted listening systems. Are assisted listening systems that are portable acceptable for smaller classrooms that do not have amplified sound?
That do not have?
Amplified sound.
Ah, okay. Potentially, that would be acceptable under equivalent facilitation. But the ADA standards, if you read the first sentence in the Department of Justice standards, where it adopts the Access Board guidelines as standards, the Department of Justice says these standards apply to the built environment, fixed things and only fixed things. So a portable assistive listening system might possibly be acceptable under equivalent facilitation, but you would need to be pretty sure that that assistive listening system is going to be put in place, ready for use, and available when it's needed. Otherwise, it's not equivalent. And an example of where we would not deem something to be equivalent would be a portable ramp. If a fixed ramp is required and you say, well, we'll bring out the ramp when people with disabilities knock on the door, we would not look at that as equivalent at all, because then it would slow down someone with a disability from accessing the facility. And the same thing with assistive listening. It should be put in place and ready for use at all times. But you have a lot of control over your facility, such as a high school or some other type of facility like that, then potentially equivalent facilitation may suffice.
Okay. Another one related to street parking. What guideline is the most comprehensive for scoping and alternatives for city street parking with funding from various sources?
That's a pretty broad question. I can direct you to our Public Rights of Way Accessibility Guidelines Notice of Proposed Rulemaking. These are not yet requirements. They hopefully will be requirements in the near future, but I have to warn you that there are always changes between a Notice of Proposed Rulemaking and a final rule. So I would urge you to take a look at the Notice of Proposed Rulemaking. Use it as guidance. Don't assume that nothing will change. And if you have any particular questions about the Notice of Proposed Rulemaking and how it scopes accessible parking, then please do call our staff. And we will be happy to help you work your way through that.
Okay. Rick, so apparently there's a grab bar on the market that turns at a 45-degree angle at approximately 6 inches from each end. It's very odd that there's about an inch and a half on either end when it starts to taper towards the wall. You want to comment on
so this? I'll see if I get this right. So this sounds like it's, if the bar kind of comes along horizontally and then it turns down or up at a 45-degree angle, it sounds like that's what's going on.
That's weird.
Yeah, you know, because so, if I'm understanding that correctly, then you would have to, the requirement for the grab bar is that it be horizontal. So once it starts to take, once it starts to deviate from that, then that's really, that person would not be compliant. And if
let me read you the exact question. There is a grab bar in the market that turns at a 45-degree angle at approximately 6 inches from each end, parentheses, versus a tight radius at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Very odd grab bar, but there is inch and a half at either end when it starts to taper towards the wall.
I don't quite get that.
I think generally, though, what you're trying to say is that the horizontal portion of that grab bar is compliant. So you would want to measure the horizontal portion and exclude from your measurement any of the angle pieces.
They've clarified it's horizontal at 45-degree angle.
Horizontal at 45-degree angle. Okay, So I can't imagine it working if it's not actually, we aren't talking about something that's no longer horizontal, because it couldn't, one never couldn't stick out. But yeah, just to reiterate what Marcia says, it really is to horizontal. Now, if that horizontal portion on the bar is, you know, as long as what's stated in the standards, nothing you can say, well, we provided, you know, something that's adequate. And then once you get beyond, like, say, if it's a 36-inch bar, once you get beyond, like, the 36 inches and you can taper it up and down and do different things, and I think, say, that still meets the, is consistent. Right.
Okay, and I think for this person who asked the question, you might want to follow up with our technical assistance hotline and, offer some additional diagram just to make sure that everyone is clear on what the question is.
Yeah, you can stick the name Rex in there, and I'll actually get that over.
Rex. Okay. So In a renovation where a window is next to the toilet, can the grab bar be placed in front of the window?
You want me to do this one, Marcia? Yeah, that sounds it sounds challenging. I don't know how you would have a consistent inch and a half space behind the bar if something like a window happens. You know, everything would have to be flush. So it seems like to me along the length of the bar there would be some distance that would be more than an inch and a half at some point or less than an inch and a half. So there's an issue to be worked out there. And additionally, I think what the standards doesn't necessarily say that you can't use a glass surface. I would be cautious about having somebody, because somebody could very well lean into it. So if you're going to have a glass surface like that, you better be sure it can hold up, and I would be concerned about it. Better make sure it's something like glass pot.
It sounds like a potential liability for the owner, not necessarily ADA liability, but certainly a liability if someone should go through that window and hurt themselves.
Yeah, I think if something that was substantial or glass block, that may work. But,
yeah.
So.
Okay. How about accessible parking? Is it required for self-parking if valet is the only parking available?
So valet is the only option you have.
Excuse me?
Valet is the only option you have.
It says accessible parking required for self-parking if valet is the only parking available.
Well, we don't address valet parking, and there's no exception anymore for valet parking because valet is a service. It's not part of the built environment. So if you have a parking lot, a parking facility, that parking facility has to have accessible spaces. Whether or not you are going to be required to allow people to self-park is going to be subject to the DOJ regulations under modifications of policies, practices, and procedures. And you would have to have a good reason not to allow people to self-park, but perhaps there are hazards or other issues that make that not possible, but you do have to have accessible parking in a parking lot that has valet service. There are some exceptions for mechanical parking garages where you have, you know, only mechanical access.
Okay, so I'm afraid we're out of time at this point, but you know that you can always call the Access Board and our hotline to get answers to any of your questions. And if you have some questions that weren't answered, most of them were during this session, please feel free to call the hotline. It's 800-872-2253, or TTY is 800-993-2822. You can also email a question to ta@access-board.gov. Go on our website at access-board.com to get updates on any rulemaking. And our next session next month will be on May 7th. It's going to be the application, talking about the application of ADA and ADA accessibility standards. So with this, I'm going to turn it over to Claudia. Claudia?
Thank you, Peggy.
Okay.
Sorry about that. For today's session, we are offering AIA and LACIS credits. Participants that are interested in getting AIA and LACIS credits, you can go ahead and email our office.
Buddy, are you really broken up?
Is that better?
Yes.
Sorry, just on my microphone there. Certificate requests for AIA can be emailed to certificates@adaconferences.org. And if you want to provide that reporting on your own, on this slide, I'm currently providing the course number, GL 2015-0305, and also our AIA provider number. If you want to qualify for the LACIS CEU, you are required to take a CE quiz at the end of today's session. It is timed, so you are limited for how long that quiz will be available. So you'll learn about that on the email that will be sent after the session. I also want to say that we are sending an email right after the session with the evaluation link. You can provide your feedback there. So with that, I want to thank our presenters and conclude today's session. To exit the webinar, click the X in the upper right-hand corner. If you're on a telephone, just hang up and disconnect. Thank you. Have a good afternoon.